Lagrangians and matter sources and actions in GR. So I know you've already sort of had one pass at this, so I know there's some level of familiarity, but it's kind of an important topic in relativity, how to be able to handle fields and gravity. So I think it's well worth going over it again and hopefully kind of bedding down a bit better what you met earlier. So the first... So the first sort of task is to decide how we go from our Lagrangian to our action. So we've already covered actually the basics of this, because to get an action, you want to integrate this Lagrangian over your space-time manifold. So we need to know how to integrate. Normally, if we were just integrating on a flat space, we'd simply take dx, dy, dz, or d3x, or d4x, or whatever. But of course, we've got our curve manifold, and so we have to have a notion of what the volume on the manifold is, rather than in some local coordinate patch. So, so we know that d4x, for example, is not covariant. It's something which is just relevant to a local coordinate patch. And we know coordinate patches are only ever a sort of approximate description of our manifold. So it would go to dx by dy, d4y, for example. However, we kind of have a pretty good idea of how to make it invariant, because we've got this object called the metric on the manifold, and the metric is telling us about proper distances. And if we want to think about what we mean by a volume is simply our sort of idea of, well, we know we've got, say, a cube, with a little bit in x, a little bit in y, and a little bit in z. So locally, if we know how to define distances in linearly independent directions, then we have a notion of what our physical volume is. So it should be no surprise, we also know, if we take our metric, and do a coordinate transformation on it, then we know we pick up factors of the determinant of the coordinate transformation. So it's really no surprise that we use the determinant of the metric in our expression for the volume measure. So that's why we use root g d4x. It really is our local volume by what we define as distance and what we define as volume. So if we think about what we're doing when we're doing field theory or dealing with Lagrangians and actions, we're usually doing a variational principle. We've got a Lagrangian. We want to find some equations of motion which determine the way our physical system evolves. And we do that by varying an action and asking that it is stationary on a solution to the equations of motion. So we need to therefore think about varying things with respect to the metric. So typically, when you're doing field theory, you're varying your action with respect to the physical fields. And in gravity, the metric, or our distance function, is our physical field. So we need to know how to vary things with respect to the metric. And so to find this object here, we use an identity for matrices, which is simply that the determinant of a matrix is the exponential of the trace of the log of the matrix. So if I make a variation, then obviously when I see exp, I simply say delta exp of something is the exp, which is the det. And then I have to vary what's in the exponent, which is trace log. Well, log just goes to 1 over, or m inverse, and then delta m. So applying that to my root g, so here I've got the square root of minus g because I'm in four Lorentzian space-time dimensions. So I'm going to get a half from the square root, minus 1 over root minus g coming from the variation of the square root of minus that g. And then I have to look at what I've got here. I've now got to take delta of det g, so I get a det g, and then it's g inverse delta g. Sorry, that trace got missed out there. So that's what I get. So if I put that together, I see that the variation of the square root of g is simply equal to itself times essentially the trace of the variation of g. And I've simply written this down in two ways, because although GAB with its indices downstairs is our physical metric, part of the requirement of our physical metric is that it is invertible. And for convenience, when we look at the Lagrangian principle in gravity, we're usually varying with respect to G inverse. So it's the same as varying with respect to G in the sense of the physical result is the same. If it's stationary with respect to G, it's going to be stationary with respect to G inverse. And so the other thing I want to bring out here is that, because I'll be using it, is that I can, by simply saying that delta is some partial derivative, I have the fact that the derivative of root g gives me my connection with two indices contracted. So that's also something I'm going to use in a minute. Okay, so hopefully so far so familiar. And now what I want to do is to look at applying this idea to some simple matter Lagrangians, and then, of course, review what the gravity Lagrangian is, and then discuss putting them together. So, an important example that seems to crop up an awful lot in gravity, no matter, which branch you seem to be working in, is how to put scalar fields together with gravity. So, a simple scalar Lagrangian would have a kinetic term and some potential in principle. So, that might be my scalar field Lagrangian. And so now I want to think about that in a more covariant context. So here, d phi squared course simply means take the derivative of phi. So for a scalar, partial differentiation is the same as covariant differentiation, so I don't have to do anything to d phi to get it to be covariant. But then when I'm taking the modulus of that, obviously I've got to use g. So this now tells me how to vary my action . So if I look at varying this action, I get a piece coming from varying the metric in d phi squared. I've got also a piece coming from varying phi in d phi squared. I've then got piece coming from varying the potential. And then finally, I've got this square root of g there. So have to vary that as well. So I can see that I've got pieces involving the scalar field and pieces involving the metric. So if I pull those off and just look at them separately, so if I look at the way the action varies with respect to phi, I haven't quite got things which are just purely proportional to delta phi. I've got to integrate by parts, but that's okay. That's allowed by the rules of the game. So I get I peel off this piece, which is proportional to delta phi. So the second bit, dv d phi, is something you would expect to see in equation of motion. And then the first bit, if I now look at this part, I see that this is equal to dA dA phi plus dA phi dA root minus g on root minus g. But then I look at what I wrote just on the board above, and I know that I can re-express this term as gamma ACC. And so what I have is grad A of phi. So that's the curved space wave operator. And so my equation of motion is simply the equivalent, it's the curved space wave equation of an interacting field. So that's exactly what you would expect to see, but souped up to live on a curved manifold. So this is our correct equation of motion. So this trick or identity or whatever of using replacing covariant derivatives with partial derivatives is quite useful. So it extends to this is in brackets. So for example, if I have a vector, its divergence, this is what we've used here, is given in terms of partial derivatives. It also works for forms. And that's true. I've shown it there for a two form, but it's true for any number of indices. So it's useful because when you take covariant derivatives and you're doing contractions, say, over covariant derivatives, you're often having to sum over an awful lot of different values for your indices. And so sometimes you've got to be quite careful to make sure that you've picked up all the non-zero coefficients of the connection gamma. And so just because a particular FAB, say F12, is zero, does not mean that the 1,2 component of what a covariant derivative of F is also going to be zero in general, if you have a sort of general tensor. However, in this particular case, because you've now reduced it to partial derivatives, in this expression, you only need to worry about the indices for which VA, the component VA, is non-zero. And so that reduces the possibility of error and also usually reduces the amount of work you have to do. So it's a really useful little identity, that one. So then if I look at what I get when I look at the variation of the scalar action with respect to the inverse metric, I now see that actually what I get is something which I would associate with the energy momentum of the scalar field. So in terms of matter actions, if I write them in a nice covariant way, including the metric on the manifold and then vary with respect to the metric, I see I get energy momentum tensor. So just as a reminder, let's just review the Einstein-Hilbert action, because this is only just giving me information about energy, pressures, stresses, etc., of that particular field. But we know that, according to Einstein, the curvature of the manifold is related to the energy momentum source. And so we should have a sort of gravitational counterpart in the action. And so just to remind you, our gravitational counterpart is the Ricci scalar. And when we look at the variation of our Ricci scalar, we pick up two pieces. So the first part, RAB delta GAB, is something that we want. It's part of the Einstein equations. We know that RAB is related to TAB. Okay, so we have to add minus a half r, but that's okay, because we get the minus a half r coming from the square root of g. So that piece is good. We like it. That's part of the Einstein equations. And so that just leaves this term. And so if we look at what it means, it's the variation of the Ricci tensor, which is the variation of the contraction of the Riemann tensor. And so what I'm going to do is just very briefly remind you of the derivation of this using a procedure called normal coordinates. I'm not entirely sure how it was demonstrated to you when you first met it. So this is equal to, so I'm just going to make sure I get my indices ordered right. So this is equal to two derivatives of the variation of the connection. So how do we see that? Well, we see it using something called normal coordinates. And these are coordinates in which, at a point, your connection vanishes. So we can always do this. The connection is not a covariant, it's not a physical object, it's a gauge object. It's a gauge object means we can change gauge to change its value. So we can change coordinates to make gamma vanish at some particular point. However, if we're in a curve manifold, we obviously can't make the derivative of gamma disappear, because our Riemann tensor is proportional to d gamma plus gamma gamma. So making gamma zero at a point means that the Riemann tensor is just d gamma at that particular place. So in the variation of the Riemann tensor at that particular point, you're just going to pick up the variation of the derivatives of gamma. Then you use the fact that in normal coordinates, the partial derivative, so I'm using all these phrases schematically, the partial derivative is equivalent to the covariant derivative. But of course, that's only if you're taking a single derivative. And so what we do with normal coordinates, we first say, okay, we're setting the connection to zero, but we have to keep track of terms which have derivatives of connections in them. We do that. We see what we've got. We've probably got an expression in which we've got partial derivatives, because in normal coordinates, our partial derivatives are the same as covariant derivatives. And then we simply set comma back to semicolon, or we set our partials back to covariant derivatives, and we're done. So that's the idea. Okay, so what I've done there in those two lines, the first line is saying I'm in normal coordinates, so in terms of the gamma-gamma parts of the Riemann tensor, I don't need to worry about those because they'll only ever give me gamma delta gamma, which is going to be zero in these special coordinates. So I only pick up the first piece, so that's what I've written there. Then I've looked at these individual delta gammas. Now, what I've got there is I've got my expression for the Christoffel symbols, which is, again, schematically G inverse, and then a particular combination of partial derivatives of G. So what I do, I could vary the G inverse, but then, what I actually do then is if I vary my G inverse, it's going to be multiplied by the derivatives of G, which are making up gamma, and gamma vanishes in normal coordinates. And so all I pick up are the derivative or the variation of the delta Gs, which are inside the Christoffels. And so basically, this is the only final expression that I pick up that is non-zero in these normal coordinates. So then I use the fact that comma is equivalent to semicolon. So I use the fact comma is equivalent to semicolon to send those partial derivatives to covariant derivatives. And I've also noticed that in the first two terms, if I'm contracting on the A and B indices, that symmetrizes with respect to both A and B and C and D. So this term and this term are both the same. So that's where the half's gone. That's why I've only got two terms there and not four. And meanwhile, for the last two terms, here you've got a trace of delta G, comma AB, which goes to semicolon AB. Contracting on it, that goes to the wave operator. And similarly here, I've already explicitly got the wave operator acting on delta G. So overall, if I look at this, I'm going to change my delta G to delta G inverse at the price of a minus sign. And so I end up with this expression, which is a total derivative. So that's why, at least in pure Einstein gravity, this term never really plays any role. So there are just two little wrinkles that are worth pointing out. One is that I just said Einstein gravity. So if I go outside of Einstein gravity, if I've got anything multiplying my Ricci scalar, which is potentially a dynamical field, that means I can't ignore this term, because on integration by parts, I'm going to get derivatives of that dynamical field. So for example, if I had a scalar tensor theory, which means I multiply my Ricci scalar, I'll put in the root G so it's obvious, if I multiply my Einstein-Hilbert action by a dynamical scalar field, then when I integrate by parts, I'm going to pick up derivatives of phi, so I get modified Einstein equations. So this is one of the easiest ways of modifying gravity. So that simple example is called Brand-Sticky theory. But you get scalars multiplying the Einstein term all over the place. You get that usually when you compact to phi, if you have extra dimensions, as we will see. So that's the first thing. Yep.
Two questions. Firstly, so when you went from that board to that board, so when you replace the comma with the semicolon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it does actually work. So this is a kind of quick and dirty way of doing it. If you really don't like it, or you're not convinced, or you just have a lot of time one Sunday afternoon, what you can do, don't worry, I have done this, what you could do is actually say, okay, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to make sure that it works. You can sit down and you can go up to, you know, from the full expression with all the gammas, and you'll find that everything does actually work out. So basically, let me see, sort of how would you, so you're worried about the fact that I've done comma going to semicolon with two derivatives rather than one in this particular case. So, so I think the only term that I'm standing here and just thinking, hang on, you know, is that for sure? Is that working? I mean, if I take my, would be if I'd varied the G inverse in this gamma, right? So that would be the only term I'd be worrying about. So I'm okay with comma going to semicolon, or rather with this expression here. So the thing is that all the first derivatives of the metric vanish in this particular coordinate system. So there's never any first derivatives of the metric. So once you believe this, comma going to semicolon, you should believe, because in covariant, do I mean that? Sorry, I'm blanking. I think it's one of these questions where it's kind of really, really obvious, but if you've gone and, you know, but you kind of just have to get on the right track to answer it in a way there that it's obvious to you. So I'll come back at the end on that. But it is true. There's no doubt that it's true.
Can I ask something relevant? Mm-hmm.
The variation of the metric.
Yeah.
Well, yes, it's a covariant tensor because G is a tensor. So the metric is a tensor. You've just shifted what your distance function is a tiny bit. So both are tensors, both are metrics, right? G is a metric, G plus delta G is a metric. So by definition, because your metric is the distance function, if G is the metric and G plus delta G is also a metric, they're both tensors, so delta G has to be a tensor. Okay. Also, the variation of, that's just reminded me of another point, which may or may not have been mentioned before, although the gammas are not tensors, any variation in a connection is a tensor. Yep. Because of this here, it's a total derivative. So I don't think I'd quite finish this line of thought, actually. So it's really because it's a total derivative. So in this case, let me just finish what I want to say about this. And then if there's still questions, we'll come back to them. So the first point I wanted to make was that this is a total derivative, so by the usual rules of the game, when you're doing a variational principle, you ignore terms that are total derivatives. So this term drops out, and we don't worry about it anymore, and we're only left with RAB in our Einstein tensor. It's only true if nothing is multiplying the Ricci scalar. The other point I want to make is that normally, when you have a total derivative, such as happens with the phi equation of motion over here, you've only got the first derivative of delta phi. So when you integrate by parts, you get delta phi on the boundary. And so typically, according to the rules of the game of variational principles, you say, I vary with respect to my field. I hold the field fixed on the boundary, and then I insist that my variation vanishes. Completely consistent procedure in the case of the scalar field. In this case, however, when I integrate by parts, what I get on the boundary is not delta G, but a derivative of delta G. And this is because the Einstein-Hilbert action is a little unusual in terms of field theory actions. Normally, our kinetic terms are just the first derivative squared. So it's like a half mv squared type of thing. Whereas the Ricci scalar consists of second derivatives of the metric. And so second derivatives are not what we would normally see as a kinetic term. So you could imagine saying, ah, but I can integrate by parts and get first derivatives. However, there's no covariant object composed of first derivatives of G. So it's typically something which has some gauge dependence. So our connection, which is the object that we have associated with derivatives of G, is not a covariant object. It's coordinate dependent. And so we want to write something that is geometric, that's invariant, so that leads us to the Ricci scalar, but comes at the price of having this slightly unusual kinetic term. And the price, we start paying the price when we look at the variational principle and see that we have to demand not only is delta G vanishing on the boundary, but derivatives of delta G. And that's it's sort of one of these subtleties. And usually, if you're just sort of looking at dynamics of an interior, you don't really care. However, if you want to start worrying more about computing actions, as indeed you do, if you want to think about, say, a tunneling process in gravity, you have to start worrying about computing a gravitational action, which means you have to worry about boundary terms. So usually we don't worry about this at the first pass, but I want to flag it because we will be worrying about it later. I'll call this a slight wrinkle in the variational principle. So what it really means is that we are, by doing this and by totally throwing away that term, we are making a much stronger assumption about the boundary. So in field theories, we're always painting them on top of some space-time, on top of some set of coordinates. And so the space-time's not participating, if you like, in the dynamics of the field theory. That's not true with gravity. And if we want to ignore this, it means we're somehow imposing a little bit more on our boundary. And we would like, and what we will do later, is we would like to start, you know, boundary is after all just some bit edge of the manifold. It could have some dynamical degrees of freedom of its own. So that's, we'll come back to that. So therefore, with those two things noted, our Einstein-Hilbert action, which is just the integral of r root g, the variation of our Einstein-Hilbert action then just gives us the Einstein tensor, because we've got nothing multiplying our root g. So we simply end up with a total derivative in terms of the delta RAB piece. And so we just end up with the RAB coming from delta R and minus a half R GAB coming from delta root G. So that's our Einstein action. So what are common field theories that you meet in gravity? We've looked at the scalar field, Lagrangian. So that's a very common thing that we meet. Another one is electromagnetism. So just pure electromagnetism. The Lagrangian is simply F squared, the field strength squared. So that's like just a kinetic term. So always remind yourself how many powers of G there are. And so for our energy momentum tensor, for electromagnetism, we see that the energy momentum tensor is given by the variation of the action with respect to the inverse metric, together with a factor of 2. And so here I've got 2 inverse metrics, so that gives me a factor of 2. So overall, I get minus FAC, FBC. And then I've got the root G piece. So that's my energy momentum tensor for the Maxwell field. So just a little note is that in 4 dimensions, this is trace free. And then, of course, we can start mixing things together. We've got the Abelian-Higgs model, for example. So we can have a charge scalar field. There, I guess. So really all I've done here, and anything else you have, tends to be more or less some sort of fairly obvious variation on this theme. So it's a variation, at least for bosonic theories, on having a scalar field and a vector gauge field. So in the abelian Higgs model, you simply put them together by charging the scalar. If you want to look at supergravity and string theory, again, bosonic, the bosonic sector, all you would do is you take the Maxwell action, and instead of having a one-form gauge field, you'd sort of have this whole slew of p-form gauge fields. So you'd sort of generalize the concept of the U1, of the A mu, because you have extended charged objects in string theory. If you could think about non-abelian gauge symmetries, you can, what else might you want to do? Pretty much everything is a generalization of this sort of basic element. And so these describe a whole range . So I thought, started writing down about, just what I've written down, abelian gauge theory or scalar field or electromagnetism, actually covers an awful lot of situations that you meet with matter and gravity. So for example, there's a set of theorems called the O'Hare theorems for black holes, most of which you get by looking at this sort of simple action. With just these building blocks here, get used an awful lot in ADS CFT to build holographic superconductors. You've got objects which crop up in cosmology, domain walls, cosmic strings, obviously, with just the scalar field, you've got inflation. Then again, you could have some sort of modified theory of gravity, dark energy. Sorry, not modified gravity. Just a dark energy theory like quintessence. So there's a lot of uses for these simple field theories in the context of gravity, so they crop up an awful lot. So the final thing I wanted to discuss before sort of finishing with the topic of actions and energy momentum is just some of the things that we tend to demand about the energy momentum of our sources in gravity. So I wanted to talk about energy conditions. So often energy is actually the sort of elephant in the room as far as gravity is concerned, because we all feel that we have a very intuitive notion of energy. And that is somehow not physically meaningful, not just to us, but somehow it has some meaning beyond our own perception. But that's not entirely true where gravity is concerned. So why is that? It's because our notion of energy sort of also carries with it a notion of conservation of energy, and a notion of conservation of energy comes from the divergence of the energy momentum tensor. And so when we have a curved manifold, the divergence of our energy momentum tensor starts to pick up some connection components. And so what that really means is that it's not true that like d rho or dE by dt vanishes in a particular system. So defining mass or energy in general relativity has actually been quite a sort of tricky process. So we do have some definitions of mass, but usually they are of the mass of an isolated system. So for example, we know how to identify M in the Schwarzschild solution with the mass of the black hole. And there's a sort of very well-defined procedure to do that. And so in terms of what do we actually have, the information in our energy momentum tensor, we end up sort of trying to say, well, we want to make sure that our energy is sensible. So what we do is we want it to be positive. Sometimes we want it, the energy to be dominant over the other components so that our momentum is always time-like. And sometimes we want to ensure that gravity is attractive. So these three things come under these energy conditions. So really all I'm trying to get across in that sort of general waffle is that we can't just have a sort of absolute value of energy and an absolute value of momentum and say, well, we demand that these are positive, because that just doesn't quite hold up on a curved manifold. So some of the things we do are we have something called the weak energy condition, which is essentially saying that rho, our energy, is greater than or equal to zero. So what do we actually mean by that? So if we have So what it means is that basically all observers would agree that their energy density was positive. So what they would measure as an energy density would be positive. And so that's really, I'm putting them on the left as rho and p, because we all have a sort of intuitive notion of what we mean by that. So the weak energy condition is simply saying energy is positive. It says absolutely nothing about pressures. So this is used in proving singularity theorems. And I guess the area theorem for black hole. So it's the minimal, it's the least you could do. Then there is the dominant or null energy condition. And that's really summed up by saying that rho is greater than or equal to mod p. And this is sort of saying that TAB KB is not space-like, so it's null or time-like. So in other words, all observers would see a time-like momentum associated with the energy momentum. So all sensible matter sources satisfy weak energy condition, and the energy momenta that you get out of usual field theories also satisfy the dominant energy condition. The one that usually gets violated is something called the strong energy condition. And in essence, that's rho plus 3p is greater than or equal to zero. So what this translates into is the statement that gravity is attractive. So that's a slightly odd thing to write, because everybody, it's one of the first things that you kind of use to distinguish gravity. Unlike electromagnetism, where like charges repel, gravity is supposed to always be attractive. Everything's always supposed to pull together. Well, actually, that's not quite true. It depends on the situation. And so in this case, we don't forget that there's a hidden C squared. This is rho, this is like rest mass energy. So this is enormous. Typically, in any normal matter, lab matter, whatever, this will always hold. But it doesn't hold in the field theories that I've written down there, not necessarily. So it's quite easy to violate this energy condition if you have quantum fields without necessarily behaving in a quantum way, as we will see. So if this condition is violated, and you can see that it's maximally violated for the cosmological constant, then gravity does not tend to be attractive. So by gravity being attractive, what I mean is if you have geodesics, they'll tend to converge. So the action of gravity will tend to be to pull things together. Whereas if this energy condition is violated and you look at geodesics, you'll find that they often want to split apart. And so that's what I mean by that, by gravity not being attractive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. I'll have to think about it. So in other words, because you're basically trying, so rho you get from looking at, picking a time like observers, tangent vector. And so basically, I guess you would have to split the metric in terms of a time-like piece and the spatial piece, and then take sort of components. If this isolates rho, I suppose you're looking at something to do with the trace of the energy momentum tensor, which would normally be, I guess, rho minus 3p. So I guess you'd take that plus twice. Something like this, maybe. Perhaps that's, with respect to a particular observer, it would be something like that anyway. Notionally, that's how you do it, taking a trace and then adding something that looks like a local energy density. But don't hold me to that precisely. Yep. No, these are local energy conditions. So that's why I was saying that in terms of you want to try and move away from the notion of an absolute energy in gravity. But what you can do is talk about what observers see locally. And it's quite useful to think about the different energy conditions that you can have. So for example, in the cosmology course, you probably see this particular relation an awful lot, because a lot of the problems in standard the sort of old-fashioned cosmology arose from the fact that people were assuming a universe with matter content that satisfied this strong energy condition. And with the strong energy condition, it means that gravity is so attractive that the universe closes off right at some beginning, the Big Bang, and it doesn't have time to equilibrate by sort of a causal physical process before nuclear synthesis, say. And so that's why you get all the problems with the old cosmology. But of course, in the very early universe, you enter, even before you have to worry about quantum gravity, you're entering into a very energetic state, and a state in which you expect that this sort of expression, these sort of quantum field theories are actually going to be playing a strong role. And if there's one thing that you kind of know, is that once you have these field theories, it's actually quite easy to violate that energy condition. And that's what inflation does. So yeah.
In other words,
no, this is a local statement. So,
yeah. The other question is whether you can do some kind of integration to make this statement to be global instead of local. Is there a way that you can... Is there some energy condition like this in the global...
So, in some cases, you can do an integration. So that's what gives you positive mass theorems, or the ADM mass, or Bondi mass. And... you know, people have had some success with a quasi-local type of mass, but it's not something, it's something you can kind of set up under certain assumptions with your space-time, but it's not something you can do in a completely generic situation. So it's kind of one of those features of gravity. No hair theorems tend to be a global statement about the space-time, and also they have far more caveats than I think people realized when they were first deriving them. So I think when people first derived the no-hair theorems, they thought they were deriving a very general set of results about black holes that would be quite would apply in a whole, you know, practically any case that you would be interested in. And of course, coming back to it with a perspective, for example, of looking at situations where you have so topological defects, for example, where you start having interesting topology in your vacuum so that you get extended objects. No hair theorems don't work with that, because there are some, you know, the assumptions that they have right up at the front just completely do not apply to that situation. They don't apply in anti-de Sitter space to the same extent. So I mean, it's one of those things where they were set up as this very general, you know, very and also quite generally applicable set of theorems, and you know, in the end, the number of cases to which they apply sort of is turning out to actually be relatively small, and you know, probably not the cases of physical interest. So it's sort of, they've had quite an interesting history.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a classic example. The holographic superconductors are a classic example where the no-hair theorems don't really apply. So, you know, in holographic superconductors, you're in anti-de Sitter space, which also changes things for the scalar field theory. And then what you find is if you have a charged black hole, sometimes they can get a scalar condensate around it. So the black hole develops this scalar hair. And in that case, it's partly the negative curvature of the space-time that does it. So, okay, better stop.